welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by OU Israel. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. This show is for Parshat Mishpatim and Parshat Shkalim. And its first recording and broadcast is Thursday, Yom Chamishi of Shabbat, Parshat Mishpatim Shkalim. Also Mochar Chodesh, also Mevorchim Chodesh Adar. On the secular calendar, it's the 15th of February. On the Jewish calendar, which I should have told you first, it's the 27th of the month of Shvat. We are soon, quick approaching Adar, the month that increases our joy as it enters. Mishenichnas Adar Marbim Besimcha. Without any further ado, as we used to say in Brooklyn, Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir ha-ma'alot mima'amakim k'raticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli, tihiena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor yah Adonai miya amod. Ki yimcha ha-slicha l'ma'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kiveta nafshi, v'lidvaro ho-cholti. Nafshi l'Adonai, mi shomerim la-boker, shomerim la-boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut. Vehu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya, haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem, viyotzieim mitzara lirvacha, umeafela laura umishibud lagu'ula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv, venomar amen. This Shabbat, as I mentioned earlier, we read Parshat Mishpatim by itself. It's a tremendously extensive study, and in addition we begin the first of the four special parshiot, Shkalim, Zachar, Para, HaChodesh. Shkalim is the Shabbat of Rosh Chodesh Adar, if that were to be a Shabbat, or as is more common, the Shabbat before Rosh Chodesh Adar. So we not only announce that Rosh Chodesh Adar will be Sunday and Monday, but we also, being the beginning of the four parshiot, we take out two Torahs on Shabbat after we read seven people in the first Torah, Parshat Mishpatim. We read a special maftir for Shkalim in the second Torah, and the Haftarah of Shkalim preempts the regular Haftarah of the Parsha of the week. And that's part of the story. Some details about Shkalim will follow. But first, let's have a listen to one little tiny focus. I often refer to Torah study as some version of underwater exploration. You can be in a glass-bottom boat skimming the surface of a lake, a sea, or whatever, and you could look through the glass and see the corals and see the pretty fish, and get a relatively superficial view of what's down there, but in the course of the boat trip, you cover a lot of ground. You can also anchor your boat, put on scuba diving gear, go under and spend hours on one particular coral formation or whatever. And there's a lot of that in Torah learning as well. What I want to do with Mishpatim is focus in on one of the many, many topics in Mishpatim, and one relatively small aspect of that, but it touches upon a lot of stuff as it is, and you will see and hopefully get something out of the shiur that I gave earlier to the Torah Tidbits folders. And you should just know that as listeners to Torah Tidbits audio, when you listen to the shear of the folders, you should feel a little guilty that you are not at the moment sitting and folding Torah Tidbits while you listen to the shear, but instead you're doing your Shabbat preparation or work around the house or whatever. Nobody will hold it against you. We appreciate the listenership of Torah Tidbits Audio, but welcome to the family, at least bystanders of the active team of volunteers who every single week do a very diligent, careful, and good job of folding Torah Tidbits. We can write it, we can print it in 8,500 copies, and collate it, but it doesn't get to people until the volunteers spend hours and hours and hours of manpower and womanpower in order to fold them into the readable form that then is distributed all over Israel, and maybe sometime soon, we've got plans, no details yet, of distribution elsewhere as well. In the meantime, you've got Torah Tidbits Audio on both Arut Sheva, Israel National Radio, as well as www.ouradio.org. To listen to it, you have the internet website www.ou.org/Torah/TT, where you've got many of the features of the hard copy, and you can also subscribe by email and receive our new HTML version of Torah Tidbits or the old-fashioned text version. A lot of different ways to get it. If you'd like to communicate with me about that, drop me an email to TTA, Torah Tidbits Audio, or TT. I get both of those addresses at ouisrael.org. I wanted to first say that Parshat Mishpatim probably contributes to more Gemara space than any other Parsha. I could probably be challenged on that, and I'm not saying it in any kind of official way. But certainly, as you go pasuk after pasuk in Mishpatim, it just reminds you of huge material in Talmud. There's a lot of detail that's not in the Sedra itself, even though the lead tidbit is called Mitzvah Popcorn. There's still more popping to do when you get into the oral law and into Talmud. I have a mission I want to share with you. It's going to take a little bit of introducing. One of the themes in Parshat Mishpatim is the Arba Shomrim, the four guardians. It's a topic which traditionally boys who start Gemara back in fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade, whatever, very often start with the topic of Shomrim from the third chapter of Bava Metzia. I don't know exactly why that was a very common first place or second place to start learning Gemara, but it's a main theme, not a main theme, it's one of the themes. You can't really say anything is a main theme in Mishpatim because there's so many of them, but it's definitely one theme in Mishpatim. The Shomrim that we're talking about have a common denominator of you are in possession of somebody else's property because he gave it to you to either do him a favor and keep an eye on it, to either pay you to keep an eye on it, to rent it to you, or to lend it to you. You are the Shomer Chinam, the one who is watching the object without being compensated for the watching, or the Shomer Sachar, the one who is being paid to watch it, or the socher, the renter, leaser, or the borrower, the shoel. So the four shomerim are shomer chinam, shomer sachar, socher, and shoel. Even though there are four shomerim, you could divide them into two categories a couple of ways. One is the shomer chinam and the shomer sachar. Common denominator there is that neither is allowed to use the object that he's guarding. Your friend said, I'm going into the store, I can't take my bicycle inside, please keep an eye on it. That does not give you permission to get on it and ride.
unless he gives you permission, in which case you're no longer a Shomer Chinam. But a Shomer Chinam is, watch the object, I'll come back in an hour, in a day, in a month, in a year, whatever, I want it back. And officially, you have no permission to use it. You can handle it to protect it, but you can't use it for your own personal use. Either, in either case of being the Shomer Chinam, where you're not getting paid for the favor, or the Shomer Sachar, where you are getting paid. The Socher, the renter, and the Shoel, the borrower, obviously have permission to use it, because that's why they rented or borrowed it. That's a major difference. In either case, you're not allowed to misuse it. In the case of the renter and the borrower, it has to be with either the specified terms of use or the expected default terms of use. Whenever a person rents a car, he sees this sticker on the dashboard that says you're not allowed to drive it on unpaved roads. That would be an example of a condition of renting. You're renting the car to drive under normal circumstances on paved roads, with the assumption that driving under unpaved roads is more wear and tear than the renter wanted to have. In Talmudic...
If you rent a car in Arizona, you're not allowed to cross into the Mexican border.
Okay. Okay, these are conditions of renting. In the Talmudic examples, if you rent an ox to pull a plow, the assumption is it's going to be in a normal field, not one with solid rocks, you know, and boulders that the ox is going to encounter, because that works him extra hard. A horse or a donkey to pull a wagon is meant to normal use, etc., etc., etc. The Shomer Chinam and the Shomer Sachar also have to watch out for negligent handling or negligent guarding of the object. Okay, I can't go into all the details, but those are just some of them. Another interesting analysis of the four Shomrim goes to how much the Shomer, meaning the one whose object it is not, but in whose possession it is, how much he's responsible for different things that happen to it. You get out of the store and you say, "Where's the bike? I told you to watch it." He says, "Yeah, but three big guys came, one of them pushed me down and the other two wheeled the bike away, or two of them pushed me down and one wheeled the bike away. It was stolen." Theft, for a Shomer Chinam, he is exempt from paying. Theft is a good excuse. He would have to provide reasonable assurance that he was not negligent, that he didn't leave the bike unchained and go someplace else, and it was stolen that way. That would not be called theft. That would be called Peshia, which means negligence, and he is responsible to pay. Officially, and all of these things can be worked out by mutual agreement, officially, a Shomer Chinam who wants to be exempted from paying for an object that is stolen will have to swear in a court that he was not negligent. And if he refuses to swear, then he has to pay. But that's a technicality. We don't have to get involved with that now. The Shomer Sachar, this is important, and it's germane to what we're going to talk about. The Shomer Sachar, the one who is hired to watch, cannot use "it was stolen" as an excuse. He has to pay you for that. In other words, the assumption is, since he is being paid by you for guarding the object, he must exercise even more protective measures and is held responsible for loss and for theft. However, there are still things that he's not held responsible for. For example, if a person rents a horse, you go to a riding stable and you pay a fee where you rent the animal for a day or in a couple of hours or whatever. If he says the animal dropped dead, not not while you were riding even. You stopped for a picnic, and the animal was tied to a tree, and the next thing you knew, it was dead on the ground. So, again, the issue of negligence is there. Did you leave him out in the sun without giving him access to water or this or that? But that's not the issue now because it's too detailed. Meta kidarka, meaning an animal that dies of its own natural causes, we'll say. Even a shomer sachar, one who's being paid, or in this case, a socher, is exempt from compensating the owner. Theft, the one who pays, is responsible for. The Shomer Chinam, less responsible. The Shomer Chinam, we'll say, is responsible only if he was negligent. All other reasons that the object or the animal is no longer there, he is exempt from paying. The Shomer Sachar and the Socher are both in the same category vis-a-vis the following idea. There is mutual benefit to the owner and to the guardian. In the case of Shomer Sachar, the owner gets his object watched, and the Shomer Sachar gets paid for it. In the case of the renter, the rentor, the one who rents out the object, is getting money. And the rentee, I don't know, whatever, the person who pays the rent is getting the benefit of the use of the object. So there's mutual.
Renter.
The borrower, doesn't matter. The borrower is at the bottom of the scale. You are doing him a favor by lending him your power drill, your cell phone, your whatever. And he is getting all the benefit. He is responsible for its safe return in almost all situations. The only one he's exempted from is called Meta Machmat Melacha, meaning if the animal died in the course of normal work. Because then it's considered that the owner had something to do with it. If the animal was pulling a regular plow, not one of these unusual situations where it's extra work, and died, then the borrower said, you lent me an animal that was going to die when it did normal work. He's not responsible for that. If it died on its own of natural causes, he does take that responsibility. He has to. He has no choice. Okay. Now, with that background, there's really one more chunk of introduction, but atypical of introductions, which usually come first. I'll save this other introductory piece for after we do the Mishnah. It's a Mishnah in Bava Metzia, just for your information. At the Seder, we say six. Who knows six? I know six. Six are the orders of the Mishnah. Shisha Sidrei Mishnah. The fourth Seder of Mishnah is called Nizikin. Literally, it means damages, but it includes much more than that, but it's all civil law. The first major portion of Seder Nizikin used to be called, once upon a long time ago, Masechet Nizikin, but it had an unwieldy 30 chapters to it, and it was subdivided into 10, 10, and 10 chapters, each one getting its own name, and the name was the first gate, the middle gate, and the last gate. In Aramaic, Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, and Bava Batra. Kama is the former, the earlier. Batra is the later. Metzia is Emtza, the one in the middle. And Bava means gate, Sha'ar. Anyway, so it's almost an arbitrary division because it's just 30 chapters, too much, 10, 10, and 10.
They're all civil?
They're all civil law. You have everything there. You have workers and bosses. You have lost and found. You have selling and buying. You have the shomrim. You have many, many different topics. Neighbors. All kind of topics covered in those three mesechtot.
Is there some logical differentiation between
them? A little bit, but I think it's closer to being the desire to cut it down to 10 chapters, 10 chapters, and 10 chapters. because there is some overlapping of topics. Now, in the middle one, called Bava Metzia, in the third chapter, in the second Mishnah, that's what we're going to take a look at. It goes like this. Hasocher para mechaveiro. A person who rents a cow from his fellow. Let's give these guys names. We'll take the traditional names. Reuven owns a cow. Shimon rents the cow from Reuven for a week and gives him a fee for it. Vehishila la'acher. And then Shimon goes and lends the cow to Levi for a day in the middle of the week. First question which we have to get out of the way, it's obvious to the commentaries in the Mishnah that it must be with permission. Because a renter cannot give it to anyone else unless there's approval from the owner. Because the normal course of events of renting work like that. Just like when you rent a car today, you have to sign who is going to be the driver of the car. And if you let someone else drive it, it's a violation of the rental agreement, and you're going to not get covered properly for an accident. Similarly, the commentaries agree that his lending the animal to the third party is with permission of the owner. By the way, convention, meaning what's done in the place where you live, is a very important factor here when it's not spelled out. Let me give you a totally different example. It's not totally different because it's related to borrowing. Can you borrow something without permission of the owner?
No.
Wait a second. You walk away from here, your pen is on the desk. Can I pick it up and write a note with it? Had you been here and I would have said, can I borrow your pen for a minute, you would have let me borrow it. So without permission, the question that's asked in the Talmud is, shoel, borrowing, shoel, shalom midaat, without permission, without knowledge of the owner, is that shoel havei? Does that constitute borrowing? Or does it constitute theft?
Let's use that as a cliffhanger for part two. We'll be right back shortly with more Torah Tidbits audio, or as E.G. Marshall put it on Old Radio Mystery Theater, we'll be back shortly with Act Two.
Yeah.
That was, as you undoubtedly were able to figure out, Mishenichnas Adar Marbim Besimcha, part of a medley of songs on an album called A Taste of Yom Tov, the Purim album, highly recommended, by the way. And even though we are only on the 27th of Shvat today, we are announcing Rosh Chodesh Adar this Shabbat, which will be Sunday and Monday. It is really Sunday night Monday that is the first day of the month of Adar, but if we're talking about a month in which we increase our joy with Nisan following, which also increases our joy, which is part of the explanation, by the way, for the concept of Mishenichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha, then I figured we could jump the gun a little and get into that mood and play Mishenichnas Adar. Now, at the end of the first half, I left you with undoubtedly one of the most dramatic cliffhangers imaginable. Whether a person who borrows without the knowledge of the owner of the item, is he considered merely a borrower, or is he considered a thief? Here's part of your answer.
A lot depends upon what is the normal practice and assumption in the place where you are. If it is considered normal that people don't mind that you jot down a note with a pen that's sitting there, provided you put it back where you took it from, and provided you don't use it to clean out the wax from your ear or chip ice off of a block, then, again, that also, I mean, I said it flippantly, but it belongs there too, because if you misuse an object that you borrow, you're responsible for it more than I was writing with it and ran out of ink. That's not my fault. That would be like dying in the course of work. Normal wear and tear. But if you come and it's broken and you say, what did you possibly do with this? Did you write something with it? He says, no, I needed to, you know, chisel something off of a piece of stone. So I had a hammer, but I didn't have a chisel, so I borrowed your pen. Obviously, you can't do that. But let's say you're in a place where people are very fussy about their personal property, and it is known that people do not like when people take their things without permission. Or people know you and know that you don't like when anyone takes something of yours without permission. Or it's a very valuable thing, which, why'd you leave it unattended? That's a different question. But all of these things are factors. It is known in the yeshiva world, especially related to Sfarim. Guy comes to the Beis Medrash, he learns there many hours a day and night, and he brings with him his reference books. So he's got a set of Rambam and a set of Shulchan Aruch and a Tanakh and a this and a that. And he's not always sitting there. He's now out someplace, and you're learning at the next table, and you want to look something up in the Rambam, and you don't have a Rambam among your Sfarim. Can you use his Rambam? In many yeshivot, I would say in most yeshivot, there's a rule of thumb. The rule of thumb is that the Sfarim that you leave on your table are available for other people to use, provided they don't take it out of the room, and provided they put it back on your table. That's, and if you want otherwise, you have to write it. You have to cover your books with book covers and write on it, Ani Makpid. Ani Makpid means I am fussy about not lending my books without permission. In places where, I guess less friendly places, where the norm is that you don't take books without permission, you could write on it, anyone who wants to borrow this book can please borrow it, make sure it gets back to where it is. So you have that kind of thing also. Again, the Mishnah. A guy rents a cow, Reuven owns a cow, Shimon rented the cow from Reuven, and during the time that he had it, he lent it to Shimon. To Levi. Umeta kedarka, and the cow died of normal natural causes overnight. Levi put it into his barn. It was properly ventilated and everything was there. We're not talking about mauled by a predator. We're not talking about an unusual circumstance. It just died. The rule is that a borrower must compensate the one who lent it to him if it dies on its own. A renter does not compensate the one he rented from if it dies on its own. So the first opinion in the Mishnah is, Yishava hasocher shemeta kidarka. Shimon only has to say it died of natural causes, and if he has to swear to it, he does. V'hashoel yishalem lasocher. Levi, the borrower, pays for the cow to Shimon, who borrowed it, who lent it to him. Not to Reuven, but Shimon does not have to pay Reuven, because Reuven rented the cow to Shimon. Shimon, as a socher, is exempt from payment for meta kedarka, dying of its natural causes, but Levi is responsible as a borrower to Shimon. That's the first opinion in the Mishnah. And your eyebrows, or your face, right? Omar Rabbi Yose. Rabbi Yose says, "Ketzad hala oses chora beparato shel chavero." How are we allowing Shimon to profit with Reuven's cow? You play the technicalities here. Reuven is not entitled to compensation because he rented the cow and is getting a fee. Levi is obligated to pay for the cow because he was a borrower. He borrowed it from Shimon. He pays Shimon. And according to that first opinion of the Mishnah, Shimon does not have to pay back to Reuven. By the way, the carcass of the cow belongs now to Levi. If he pays for the cow, he's the one, it died on his hands, he has to pay for it, but he keeps the carcass. Because a carcass of an animal is worth something, not as much as a live cow, but it's worth something. Now, Rabbi Yose is disturbed here by the seeming unfairness of the situation, which leads me to the other introductory remarks that I wanted to give. Being unfair does not always make a situation halachically wrong. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Let me say it again. Let me give you an example. Let's say you make jewelry and you sell it. I come one day, I look at your jewelry, I point to a particular necklace, I said, I'd like to buy that, how much is it? You say, 50 shekel. I said, okay, here's 50 shekel, I give it to you. You even write me a receipt. I said, can you do me a favor, I'm not going home now, I really don't want to carry this around. I'll come back tomorrow morning and I'll pick it up. Person says, sure, I paid for it and got a receipt. Person says, no problem, and I go. Later in the day, the necklace is still on the counter. Person sees it and says, I really, really like that necklace. Give you 70 shekel for it. Person says to himself, 70 shekel. Well, the guy's only paying me 50 for it. Maybe you bargained him down or whatever. So he sells the second person the necklace for 70 shekel. You come tomorrow morning. You hand him the receipt. Where's my necklace? I don't have it anymore. Here's your 50 shekel back. What do you mean you don't have it anymore? Well, the fact is, I sold it to somebody. You sold it to somebody? What do you mean you sold it? I bought it yesterday. I gave you the 50 shekel. You gave me a receipt. Where's my necklace? I don't want the 50 shekel back. I want that necklace. It was a one of a kind, and that's it. And you take him to court, to Beit Din. The court will say, after they hear the whole thing, according to the rules of buying and selling, the fact that you gave money does not yet make it yours, because for movable items like jewelry, that which acquires it is taking physical possession, picking it up, which you didn't do. Money is what you have to pay because he's not giving it to you as a gift. You have to give him money. But halacha, the working of Jewish law, needs to know the moment that something transfers ownership. And they determined that the ownership is transferred when the item is picked up. Therefore, the court will say to him, the jewelry maker, you did a not nice thing. You had sold it already. You got money for it. You even gave her a receipt. The guy was coming to pick it up. You had no right, no business selling it to someone else. But they have to shrug and they say, Masha asa asui. What is done, which means you, the one who bought it the first time, have no claim to go to the second buyer, bring him to court and say, that's the necklace that I bought, it's mine, I want it back. If it was yours, if it were yours, I wasn't going home and I didn't want to carry it on me because I was going swimming and I didn't want it to get wet. I don't care, it doesn't
what
matter
if
what.
Picked up off the counter and then put it down.
If he had picked it up and then said, can you do me a favor and hold this for me till tomorrow, then it's yours.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah.
But there's a drawback to that side also. Let's say the guy had a mudslide, devastated his store, and everything got ruined, including your necklace.
But if it's yours, he doesn't have to pay.
Right, he doesn't have to pay. If it's not yours, he does have to pay. In other words, you need to know sometimes what's the moment of acquisition. Wait, we're not finished. And if you don't hear it to the end, you're not going to get the whole story here. So we say to this guy, naughty, 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 not allowed to do that, but you did, and by the technicality of when ownership is there, the sale is a good sale to that third party, but the halacha says you give this guy a mishapora. A mishapora is the opposite of a mishaberach. You know what a mishaberach is?
Yeah.
A mishapora means he's called before the Beit Din, and this goes into the record of the Beit Din, and the Beit Din says, mishapora, he who exacted punishment, meaning God, from the generation of the Mabul, of the flood, for all of their nasty behavior. And he who exacted punishment from, and they keep going on and on and on, from all the wicked people in the world, should exact punishment, in other words, it's in God's hands, from a Jew who gives his word and doesn't keep it. It's like a curse. Now, it could be where the guy will say, I feel terrible and I'll do something about it. Or he can laugh in the court's face. That's up to him. It's not excommunication. That goes further. But that's the story. In other words, the idea of a mishapora is the court says our hands are tied legally. You didn't do a right thing. The language in Shulchan Aruch is lo asa ma'ase Yisrael. You didn't behave like a good Jew is supposed to behave. But where's my necklace? That's the bottom line. If that's the bottom line, the answer is the guy that bought it in the afternoon, it's his. You want to go buy it from him? That's up to him. You want to use the 50 shekel? You want to get more? Whatever. The point is, things are not always fair, but they need to be technical. Obviously, if people are nice and good, they're going to do beyond the technicality of the halacha. So here, the nice thing is for Shimon to give the money that he got from Levi for the cow to Reuven, who lost the cow. But according to the first opinion of the Mishnah, he doesn't have to. He should. That I'm adding. Now comes Rabbi Yossi's answer. Ela tachzor hapara leba'alim. No. Reuven gets the money. Wait, stop. I've just been making a case for the technicalities here that it goes to Shimon, and it does not go by law to Reuven. Rabbi Yossi, we could say, is sentimental, wants to be fair, wants Reuven to get compensated for the cow that died, but it's got to be by the law as well. So the commentaries explain it to us as follows. Again, I want you to get this because this is really my point. Wanting to be fair is one thing. Feeling that something was unjust is one thing. But doing something about it has to be done without bending the technicalities of halacha, because they're going to boomerang on you some other time. They'll backfire. And this is how they explain it. And it goes back to one of the first things that I said about this case. Remember I said that he can't. The renter cannot lend it to someone else without permission of the owner. Permission of the owner is construed as agency, meaning shlichut, meaning it's as if he said, which he didn't say, but this is Rabbi Yossi's argument, it's as if Reuven said, I am renting you this cow. If you so choose to lend it or rent it to anyone else, it is as my representative. It's not yours to do anything you want. It's yours to use in the normal manner. If you so choose to rent it, to sublet, or to lend it to someone, which is the issue of this Mishnah, then it is construed as being in the agency of Reuven. Now, according to Rabbi Yossi, Reuven gets his money. Not because the rules changed, but because we view what happened differently. We say that it was not Shimon that lent his cow to Levi. It was Shimon who lent Reuven's cow to Levi as the shaliach, the agent of Reuven. Then the rule is Levi has to pay and the money goes to Reuven. And that's the conclusion of the Mishnah, thanks to Rabbi Yossi. A lot of things here to think about, but hope you got the main idea.
One important general point about Mishpatim before we go on to Shkalim. And that is that Mishpatim is part of revelation at Sinai, no less than the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments. People, Jews as well as non-Jews, tend to look at the Torah, the Bible, and see that in the portion which we call Yitro, there is the account of Ma'amad Har Sinai, the Sinai experience. The super focus there is the Aseret HaDibrot. And then, in the next portion, it's Ve'elah HaMishpatim, and these are the statutes which you shall teach the people and present to them. And people get the erroneous impression that that somehow comes later. That's somehow perhaps commentary to that which God revealed. A very significant part of the traditional Torah belief is that all of the Torah was given by God at Sinai. The Ten Commandments, we could call them the down payment, written in stone and presented to the people, broken the first time, then rewritten and presented to them again. And the content of the entire Torah, we believe, was given by God to Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses our teacher, over the 40 days and 40 nights that he remained on Mount Sinai, in order to teach the people of Israel and transmit to them the entire body of God's Torah. In fact, the famous dramatic statement of the people of Israel answering in unison and in unity, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do and we will understand, listen, and accept, comes not in Parshat Yitro, where the beginning of the account of Sinai is, but it comes towards the end of Parshat Mishpatim. And I believe it's there to include Parshat Mishpatim into the whole flavor of the Sinai experience. Don't shortchange the scope of Torah, the scope of Torah as God's Word. A lot of people do, and it's very, very wrong to do that. Here now is the short version of shkalim, shekels, money. The Jewish people are commanded to make an annual collection of half shekel, silver shekel coin from each Jew. Males are obligated, women can give optional to this. The fund produced by the collection of the half shekel was used for the communal offerings in the Beit HaMikdash in the temple. Its use as a census aside, its main purpose annually were to provide the funds for the communal offerings. And therefore, it's very significant that the Torah says, He'ashir lo yarbeh v'hadal lo yam'it, a rich person can't give more and a poor person can't give less. Everybody participates equally. We don't have a Beit HaMikdash today, and we don't have the mitzvah of Shkalim, but we do have Zecher, a commemoration of the half-shekel mitzvah, and one of those commemorations is the annual reading of the portion of Machatzit HaShekel, the half-shekel, as the second Torah reading of the Shabbat right before Rosh Chodesh Adar. That's about all I have time to say to you. There is a lot more, and hopefully it will be on the OU radio version as well as the on-demand version in Israel National Radio. But for now, let me wish you a Shabbat Shalom, a Chodesh Tov, l'hishtameah. I'm often hesitant to promise that there'll be more because occasionally it's just been the 23 plus 23, 46-minute show. But quite often I have a chance to add some before it goes up to New York, and now we're going to try to send that same file to Israel National Radio, and the only people who will not be hearing these words that I am speaking at this moment are the people who listened only on the live stream, the first broadcast, 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Thursday. Anyone else on either OU Radio or on the audio on demand of Israel National Radio will be hearing these words, provided they listened after I said Shabbat Shalom, Chodesh Tov, and L'Hishtameah. So now I want to take the opportunity to elaborate a little bit more on what I was saying about Shkalim. The straight, plain issue is simply the Mishnah in Masechet Shkalim, right at the beginning, tells us that it was on Rosh Chodesh Adar that announcements were made throughout the Jewish communities in Eretz Yisrael for people to get their Shkalim ready. And as a commemoration of that mitzvah of Shkalim, it was decided to read the portion that commands it, which are the first six verses in Parshat Ki Tisa, which we happen to be reading in a couple of weeks from now, but it's the way it works. And that's one of the commemorations. The other commemoration is the giving, what's called Zecher L'Machatzit HaShekel, commemorative of the half-shekel coin. One has to be careful not to say, I am giving the half-shekel, because that's a mitzvah that applies only in the time of the Beit HaMikdash. What we should say is, I am giving Zecher L'Machatzit HaShekel, commemorative of the Machatzit HaShekel. The custom is to give half of the currency of your country. That means a half dollar, a half pound, a half zlata, etc., etc. In Israel, we not only can give the half coin of the currency, but the currency is called shekel. The half of the coin is called a half shekel, and therefore it makes even a more full commemoration. Still, you say Zecher L'Machatzit HaShekel. The custom is to give three half-shekel coins. It's based on the fact that in the portion that deals with the mitzvah of Machatzit HaShekel, the half-shekel of silver, it mentions the term Teruma Lashem, a gift to God, three times. There's a further enhancement of the custom, and that is to give the value of the original Machatzit HaShekel of silver. And what a lot of people will do is give three, in Israel, three half-shekel coins and add to that a sum which brings the total to about 9, 10 shekel, 11 shekel, I don't remember. Each year I check the current rate of an ounce of silver, and I use the figures that we have more or less quantifying the amount of silver in the original Shekel HaKodesh, the holy silver shekel that's referred to many times in the Torah, and that's what's given on the day before Purim, or on the afternoon of Tanit Esther, which is often and in many places the same, not this year, and right before Megillah reading, there are various customs. Shuls will put out collection plates for the purpose of people contributing to the commemoration of the silver shekel, and the funds go to usually poor people, and each shul has its own procedures of who to collect for and who to give. The other reason that is offered for Parshat Shkalim is based on the Talmud Yerushalmi, known as the Palestinian Talmud or the Jerusalem Talmud, and there it gives a significant additional slant to the practice of reading the portion about Shkalim at the beginning of Adar. Purim, of course, is the 14th and the 15th of Adar, or I should say, or the 14th or the 15th of Adar, but the whole month of Adar is infused with the spirit of Purim. And right up front at the beginning of Adar, the notion is, according to the Yerushalmi, that we preempt Haman's Shkalim with our own. What do we mean by that? The Megillat Esther tells us that Haman went to the king, Ahasuerus, and he offered him a significant contribution to his treasury for permission to basically conduct pogroms in order to kill all of the Jews within the provinces. You have this nation that is scattered among your provinces, and it doesn't pay for you to protect them and keep them alive. Let us do the work and kill them, and we will bring to your coffers the sum of 10,000 kikar kesef, 10,000 talents of silver, which our sages in their commentaries point out is equal to 300,000 shkalim, which is exactly 600,000 half shekels. 600,000 is the traditional number of the males of military age who left Egypt. The total population was somewhere between 2 and 3 million, but we still refer to the multitude of Jews who left Egypt. In other words, the multitude who began the nation, the first members of Bnei Israel, we call them the 600,000. And their half shekel collection that very first time for the purpose of counting would total 300,000 shekels. So we say to God, so to speak, our shekels trump Haman's shekels. We preempt his destructive shekels that he promised Ahasuerus for killing the Jews with this kofer nefesh, a redemption of the soul contribution, which not only equals that amount which he promised Ahasuerus for the job, but it also represents putting a lie to what Ahasuerus said, what the Haman said to Ahasuerus, that the people are scattered throughout the provinces and they lack unity, when machatzit ha-shekel, the half shekel, is a symbol of unity. Because everybody contributed, it was like a membership right in Klal Yisrael, and the money was used for the communal offerings that are offered in the temple on behalf of not individual Jews, but on behalf of Klal Yisrael, the whole of the nation of Israel. And that's a significant statement against that which Haman tried to convince Ahasuerus. Not only was it used for communal offerings, and this is one of my favorite examples of the use of the shkalim, one of its uses was to purchase the salt that was used in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, in fulfillment of the Torah's command on all sacrifices, on all korbanot, you shall put salt. And that includes not only the communal offerings, but the private individual ones as well. So here is a person who says, yes, I contributed towards the bringing of the daily sacrifice in the morning and in the afternoon, and the incense offering, and the oil for the menorah, which is part of Klal Yisrael. But right now, I am offering a private personal, me, myself, and I only korban. I have a bull, and I have the wine that goes with it, and I have the oil and flour mixtures and the spices, and I am contributing this korban to the Beit HaMikdash, offering it, let's say, in thanksgiving for an event in the family, and it's mine. And because I want it to be mine, I bring with me a little bag of salt and I give it to the Kohen and I say, please use this salt on my korban. And he says, I'm sorry, but salt for your korban comes from the communal fund. That means that there is no exclusive I, me, myself. There is the individual. He is very, very valued in Jewish life, but he cannot separate himself from everyone else. He is part of the community of Israel. The salt represents that. The half shekel, which pays for the salt and so many other things of communal nature, demonstrates that unity which the Jews have and must have. Our standards for Jewish unity were set in last week's Torah reading of Yitro, when the Torah describes the people traveling from Egypt, stopping a few places, coming to Sinai, and camping at the foot of Mount Sinai. There, the language changes, the grammar changes from plural, they traveled, they camped, they arrived, to Vayichan Shom Yisrael Neged Hahar, and it, Israel, camped opposite the mount. Rashi says, Vayichan, singular, Ki'ish Echad, Belev Echad. It describes a unity which sets the standard for what we must strive for. We all know that we very often fail to get near that level of unity, but it's always our goal, and it is always, should be our goal, and it always is that standard that we hold up to inspire us to efforts of greater unity. I remember a number of years ago seeing a documentary on television about one of the former Soviet Union countries, might have been Belarus, I don't remember exactly, and there was a piece of an interview with a non-Jew who lives there, who was asked and was talking about the exodus of many, many Jews from the former Soviet Union. And he said, don't think that it's only the Jews who wanted to get out of all parts of Russia. We all did. But the Jews were the only people who had other people around the world that cared for them. There were Jews, and this guy was envious, you could see it. There were Jews in whatever, former Soviet Union, all of the provinces thereof, who had the support, financial, emotional, psychological, in protesting around the world, let my people go. And he had a place to go to, Israel. And he had people who welcomed him in Israel and elsewhere. And organizations that take care of Russian Jews who come to this place and that place and the other place. And he says, we, meaning the non-Jews here, have that very sad, depressing feeling that nobody else cares about us. It was a wonderful, I mean, I'm sorry for him and I'm sorry for other people, but it was a wonderful portrayal of that ideal of Jewish unity. And I've seen it in Israel in many different respects. I saw it when Ethiopians came en masse to Israel. The feeling of fellow Jews are coming home. They are not. The situation is not without its problems. But that's because we sometimes fail to reach the unity that we should have. But the difference in the color of a skin between one Jew and another Jew should be nothing more than the fact that this person has dark skin and this person has light skin. There is no other difference between them because of the common factor of their being Jewish is so far greater than anything that separates them. Yes, there are cultural differences even within the Jewishness that they represent. But those are all minor compared to the unity. And if anyone is listening to these words and is nodding their head in sarcastic derision of what I'm saying because of many facts on the ground, I say again, there is a difference between what Judaism is supposed to do and what unfortunately some Jews or many Jews actually do. But again, it is what we should teach our children, what we should practice ourselves, what we should encourage them to do. And you know what? The end product of our caring of this idea, in this idea, is that we will realize it and get that unity as expressed by the words, Vayichan Shom Yisrael Neged Ha'har. I'd like to finish this show with a beautiful song. It's a song from an album by Mutti Kornfeld and Sons. Beautiful album. The song's words come from one of the Zmirot of Motzoi Shabbat. I would say the average Jewish household, even the ones where they sing Zmirot on Friday night and on Shabbat day, and maybe even Suda Shlishit, there are much fewer places where they also have a Malava Malka on Motzoi Shabbat where they sing Zmirot. I may be understating it, but I don't know how many people actually say these things, and it's very nice to take a look at them sometimes, and this is the way to do it with a song like this. Especially since this Motzoi Shabbat is also the beginning of Rosh Chodesh Adar, and this particular Zemer, which is called B'motzoei Menucha is at the departure of the day of contentment and rest, has a built-in prayer for the month. So when Rosh Chodesh is Motzoi Shabbat, it's extra appropriate. The words, Yehi HaChodesh Hazeh, may this month be kinevuat avi chozeh, like the prophecy of Moshe Rabbeinu, v'yishama b'bayit zeh kol sason v'kol simcha, and should be heard from this house the sound of joy and happiness. Chazak yemalei mishaloteinu. Chazak means the strong one, capital S, God. May he fulfill our requests. Amitz, another term for God, the firm one. Ya'ase bakashoteinu, may he do our petitions. For hu yishlach b'maase yadeinu, and he should send into our handiworks. Remember, this is from the Motzoi Shabbat Zmirot, and therefore after a day of laying at rest the creative activities of our hands in homage to God, we pick up on Motzoi Shabbat and resume our work. So we ask at this very auspicious moment that God bless our handiworks, bracha v'hatzlacha, with blessing and success. The song is so beautiful that I would like to leave that taste in your ears and in your heart and soul. And therefore, I will say now, Shabbat Shalom, a Chodesh Tov and a Chodesh Sameach. And may we see in the month of Adar, which represents the change of our fate from looking down to looking up, v'nahafochu, that it should be so with world events as well, the problems with our own neighbors and indigenous population, the problems with Iran and many other problems around the world, problems for the good people of the world and problems for the Jewish people. And may we see the Vinahafochu And may we emerge from darkness, especially the families of the captive soldiers and many other Jews in dire straits. May they emerge into the light that is represented by Megillah and Purim. Again, Mati Kornfeld and Sons, Yehi HaChodesh Hazeh Kenevuat Avi Chozeh Vishama Babayet Zeh Kol Sason V'Kol Simcha Chazak Yemalei Mishaloteinu Amitz Ya'aseh Bakoshoteinu V'Hu Yishlach B'Maaseh Yadeinu Bracha V'Hatzlacha. Shabbat Shalom, Chodesh Tov, and L'Hishtameya.
chazakim amen yishav yiseinu ahamitz yaseh bakasha aseinu vehu yishlach b'maseh yadeinu bracha v'hatzlacha danam tidanam Say your day new.